They want. That's the OJ's with the number one hit on the R&B singles chart in the summer of 1975. It's from their album Survival. The OJ's were formed in Canton, Ohio in 1958, while its five original members were still in high school. How about that? This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's our first Free Your Mind Friday for 2016. Certainly, we have a lot on our plate, at least presumably, to talk about. And, of course, you know, Free Your Mind Friday is an open forum where you bring your ideas, your thoughts, your opinions, your analyses of current events, or of other significant news and issues that you think are worthy of further discussion and debate. 888-874-4888. Let's start talking and see what you're thinking. And we start in New York with Joel. Hello, Joel. Happy New Year to you.
And a very happy New Year to you. I hope everything is well with you and that this year brings you the same kind of rise in consciousness, self-awareness, and good health that the last few months have brought you.
Thank you so much for that. And the same back at you.
You're welcome.
What's on your mind today?
I've kind of been out of the loop for the past few weeks. So like everybody else, I've had a lot of family obligations. I haven't had a chance to really catch up, but I noticed that you did do a series of programs recapping the year's events, which I thought was interesting. And as usual, you had a really good program yesterday when you had Dr. Horn on, who once again provided a really interesting synthesis of things that have happened. And I'd like to talk about a few things that he brought up, if I may.
Sure.
And once again, I mean, I think I mentioned this, I might have mentioned, I recall mentioning this about a year or two ago, one of his broadcasts that he was on, and that is, I'm still confused about what he means by the left. And I find it a little ironic. I'm not about to say that I'm a Horn expert. I mean, you've got to read for a long, long time, I've got to read a lot of his stuff for a long, long time to really, have a sense of his entire corpus. But I've read a few of his books, so I think I know something about his work. And one of the things that I think I can say with assurance about Dr. Horn is that he is, if not the leading historian on Pan-American and Pan-African history, certainly one of the leading historians. And he has made his name as a radical revisionist historian. And as such, he is his work is really infused with an incredible amount, as you know, an incredible amount of detail because he is revising Orthodox opinion. And as a result, he really relies upon an assiduous use of fact. And facts, the Dr. Horn matter? Even if they make us uncomfortable, and as a result, elementary morality for him matters, even if it leads us into places where we dare not enter. And so he really makes use of fact, and so that's where I'm a little confused about. Let me tell you what I mean by the left. What I mean by the left is any broad, organized political force that holds as a principle the need for far-reaching social and institutional change and consistently upholds the interests of the disadvantaged against the most powerful groups in our society. And the liberals in the United States have never been such a force. So what do I mean by liberals? I would say that liberals are those who subscribe to an ideology that holds that American capitalism is a revolutionary force for social change, that economic growth is supremely good because it obviates the need for a redistributive politics, it obviates the need for social conflict, and these things, redistribution and social conflict, have no place in American politics. And not only are those not the ideas of the left at the theoretical level, they provide a kind of sophisticated rationale for avoiding fundamental change. In practice, it seems to me that liberals have always been more concerned about distinguishing themselves from the left than about distinguishing themselves from conservatives. And so I think that the confusion between liberals and the left arose partly, perhaps, because in the 1950s, liberal was often used as a euphemism for left. In the McCarthy era, to call someone a person of left carried a whiff of treason with it. You know what I mean? But to call a person a liberal was a kind of graceful alternative. And I think a deeper reason for the confusion lay in the fact that the very parts of American society that might have been expected to hold out as the bastion of the left, rather than really coming to the fore, it is the liberals who triumphed. And organized labor, the intelligentsia, the universities became the citadels of what was, in effect, a conservative liberalism. So that's why I think it's really, really important to have a more precise approach to what we mean by liberals and left. And as a result, when Dr. Horn spoke about the Sanders candidacy, and when he spoke about Obamacare, and when he spoke about the Cy Hirsch article in the London Review of Books, which I read, I think that's where the confusion really manifested itself. Certainly it manifested itself with his comments about the Sanders candidacy. Sanders, as I've said again and again, about three or four times on your program, is not a socialist. He is a social democrat. The one politician that he most remarkably reminds me of is Hubert Humphrey, who, again, for your younger listeners, was a young mayor of Minneapolis who appeared at the faithful Democratic Convention of 1948 when the Dixiecrats walked out and announced that we needed a civil rights plank in the Democratic platform and was thereafter seen as the great civil rights senator in the Democratic Party, but he was also a fierce, cold warrior like Sanders, in effect. I think to say that it's good that Sanders is running because at least it prevents a voice for some kind of more incremental but very important reform, but incremental liberal reform, while at the same time allowing for his imperialism, to me indicates that this is a guy who is not on the left. I mean, after all, when Sanders accepts American foreign policy, the militarization of American policy, and he does, when he accepts the militarization of the American police, which then, of course, are going to be used against black people, which he does, he is not really taking positions that are compatible with positions that somebody on the left would take. So, and I think the same problem existed when he talked about Obamacare. I mean, it's one thing to say that 17 million more people are being covered under this program, but Obamacare was written by the five major insurance companies. And as anybody who has had experience under this plan knows, it has completely it's really, in effect, gotten out of control. I mean, the premiums are so expensive now that it really has become a plan that is far more, I think it's far more accurate to call it a catastrophic plan rather than an ordinary an ordinary health plan, because the premiums are so high that it really only it really forces people to pay a tremendous amount of money. And as a matter of fact, many of the co-ops that were formed, especially in the state of Colorado, have gone out of business because they're completely undercapitalized, underfunded. And we could see all this coming when the public option was dropped, which was the plan all along. I mean, does one really think that the five major insurance companies are going to accept anything that even vaguely resembles national health insurance? So I think that, you know, that we need to talk about these things a little bit more concretely, and at the same time I think a more coherent understanding of the distinctions that are placed between liberals and left. And I can tell you, Utrice, that once Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, she's going to pose as a kind of liberal, because we know who we're going to face. We're going to face either one of the Cubans or Trump. And so, again, we're going to get this kind of ambiguous distortion of nomenclature, which will really affect the way we approach politics. And we really should approach things concretely, because we need to organize. And we can't organize unless we have a clear consciousness of what it is that we want to organize about and who we are.
Well, this point that you're raising is a point that I raise all the time. In fact, I posed a question about the what is the proper nomenclature as it relates to Bernie Sanders. He says he's a democratic socialist. What does that mean? I've been asking this question for a while. What does it mean? And certainly, what does he mean? I can't kind of put my finger on it. I could tell by his actions and by his votes and by his non-actions that it isn't what I thought it was going to be as a democratic socialist, having to be compelled through a protest to address this question of police killings and so forth.
Right.
So,
right.
But in the political world, is this enough of? Are there enough people raising the same question as you, do you think?
Well, I don't think so. You know what? The question that I'm really raising, Utrice, is that I think we have to take a real look in the mirror at this country and say to ourselves, what is it that we want our politics to be like? It is never, getting back to the left again, which is why I called, it is never the problem with the left. Is that the left has forgotten that it is never our, at least it hasn't been our intention since the late 1940s to seize power, to hold power itself. It has been our intention to try to civilize those who are in power, to put pressure on those who are in power so that it will begin, they will then proceed to put into practice either those incremental changes that are at the minimum necessary, or the changes that will lead to a transformative nature in society. That means that we have to forget about electoral politics and think of ourselves as creating movement politics. What do I mean by that? I mean that in a place like Ferguson, we need to support young kids who are out there fighting the established black leadership who doesn't want to do a damn about that thing, and work with them as a coalition in movement politics to try to get things changed. That means we have to support those young kids in Cleveland who went to the AG McGinty's house and boycotted and demonstrated there. And we need to help them, and we need to do it again and again and again. We have to create popular movements. We have to engage in militant, nonviolent action. We have to be willing to go to jail. We have to be willing to make certain sacrifices, because really the country is at stake. And if we think that voting for any of these two bourgeois parties, these two corporate parties, is going to bring the kind of necessary change that can bring justice and happiness to our lives, we're deluding ourselves. And if we think that someone like Sanders, who really is nothing more than a Democratic politician, who after all supports the imperialistic policies of the United States And if you support imperialism, it means you also are wedded to militarism and to racism abroad, because that's what imperialism is. And that, and we know that when empires collapse, the same kind of behavior that they pursue on the periphery, they begin to pursue back home. So there have been 80,000 SWAT attacks in the United States in 2015. You know, we know what SWAT attacks are. These men in Kalvar on steroids, kicking open doors and killing anyone that they see because they suspect somebody has drugs. This is the kind of behavior that we saw in the imperial periphery. Now we're seeing it at home, writ large. And when you support war, you support what's going on at home as well. So we can't assume that that anyone in the two major parties are going to help us. We need to organize. We need to recognize that it's going to require sacrifice, and we have to have a consciousness of why we are organizing, or else nothing good is going to happen. But I didn't want to get off on that rant. I just wanted to talk about
the distinction. But it was a good rant and a necessary one and a very relevant one, too. Thank you so much, Joel, for getting us started today.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We go to Dallas next with Sarah. Hello, Sarah. How are you doing?
Greetings to you, Yutreath, and greetings to the PRN listeners.
Thank you.
Yutreath, the topic that I wanted to cover today is the care for our elders, and especially people who have given us as much as they have given us, and I'm sure you're very familiar with the situation with Dr. Clark, Dr. Bennett, and many of our scholars who have given their whole life currency towards helping the situation with black people, and that in their ending days they are basically left out here with no kind of support. And first and foremost, I want to give I don't know if you had covered this with Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, who transitioned to be with the ancestors.
Yes, I was aware of that only this week, really.
Yes, ma'am. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, noted psychiatrist, transitioned on the 2nd of January to be with the ancestors. And even though it's a very trying and it's a very sad time for us, we know that in her transition, she was met with the Council of Elders and the Council of Honored Ancestors, to include Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Mrs. Rosa Parks, and all of them who were there to help her make the transition. But she was also with some very good company, because we have Dr. Sheikh Ansah Jope, the famous Senegalese physicist, whose Earth Day was on the 29th of December. We have Dr. Yusuf Ben Yochanan. His Earth Day was the 31st of December. And of course, we have Dr. John Henry Clark on the 1st. So these were all there to greet her as she made her transition, as an guide her into the spiritual realm of the ancestors, to make her comfortable as she transitioned out of this flesh into the spiritual form. But the thing is that what got me concerned, Yutreath, and this is something that Dr. Welsing has always said, is we need to do. We need to call names. We need to call things by their proper names, and not have to say thee or thou and all of these other names. The problem that Dr. Welsing was being gentrification was used as a tool on Dr. Welsing by the Jewish Day School in Washington, D.C., within which to try to acquire her property. Now, she's been going through an ongoing battle with this school, who has been using noise pollution as a tactic within which to drive her from her residence. And she made a very profound statement in an article that she did with Askia Muhammad in the Final Call newspaper back in April of 2013. And she stated that her physician told her that with a constant noise for a woman of her age, it could result in a heart attack, a stroke, and whatever. And lo and behold, she predicted it. That is exactly what happened. Because she said she could not use, she said the noise was so intense that she had to leave her house, within which to gain some peace of mind. And I know you, Teresa, as somebody who's getting up in age, you know, Dr. Welsing had me by a few decades. But I know I can't take noise. These children, sometimes, you know, with the children that are being around in my area, I have to do the same thing. I have to get away from them because the noise level, because children of nowadays, it seems that they can't play like we used to do back in our time and be quiet before we get called into the house for being loud. These children are extremely loud. They're extremely noisy. And it does something to me that I can't take this noise. And she said it was the same thing. So if, imagine that you are a prisoner in your own home where you can't use, you can't open your windows. In the summertime, you can't go on your porch. You can't entertain friends on your patio or whatever, because this school, their mission, because she's the only remaining home there, and they were their mission was to drive her out of this out of her home so that they could complete the plan to take over that entire block. And this woman suffered a stroke. And what made this so very, you know, hard for me, Utrecht, when I heard this situation with her, is that we have all of these noted scholars, you know, Dr. Francis Cress Wells and Dr. Julia here. And these people who specializes in liberation of the black people's mind, you know, they're trying to get us to get our right peace of mind, right frame of reference together as descendants of formerly enslaved people to try and get us into thinking and conceptualizing a means of us to gain some sort of liberation and justice for ourselves. And these people, it seems that their minds get attacked. They lose their minds because with Dr. Wilson's case, she suffers two strokes on the right and her left side, and she was technically brain dead when she was discovered in her home. Dr. Julia Harris is in the latter stage of Alzheimer's, where our mind is gone. So we have these brilliant people. And it seems so very, very, very unjust that these people, that their minds are one of the things that get taken from them before the body finally gives up. And the only thing that I want to give this audience to do is that we have got to be a bit more. We don't have to wait until these people die and everybody gets and start crying and saying how great and whatever they have done for us. We need to do it while these people are alive. We need to show some appreciation, because she was looking for some help within which to resolve this matter legally in the court system, and she's been doing this since 2010. And we have all, we black people like to talk, oh, we have all these important black people, and we have this, and we have that. And she couldn't get anybody to help her. And this is in the nation's capital. We all have to take that black people are this, and black people are. So it has shown the fallacy of us thinking that, okay, the more you advance in this system, and you get these so-called jobs that you have, that you are some or the other, that you're, all you're doing is that you're here to support a system of white supremacy. You're not here to help your people. Because if we were really and truly as so-called powerful as I like to hear, black people like to throw this word around, that black people are powerful and we are this and we are that. If you were that powerful, it would not, this is in 2016, she would not have been going this battle by herself, have several lawyers to take on her case and then drop her once they found out who she is going up against. And it once again shows this myth, as Dr. Wilson said in this article, of the so-called black and Jewish alliance, that we have been always running around here with saying that we have this so-called alliance. And these are the same people up there who did not want to say, step in and says, okay, if we have this alliance and we did all of these things together, okay, this is an elderly woman. We need to put up a buffer zone. We need to put up a wall, because she's laid out all of the different things and the ordinance, and they're violating every one of these ordinances, which is normally what happens.
As I said, I just learned about it early this week, and I'm going to take a look, because she made a major contribution to the consciousness of African Americans and people generally, but particularly addressing the unique informational deficit among African Americans in terms of knowledge of self. And she certainly should have a special attention, and I aim to do that. But thanks for bringing that to our attention, and also to drive home the point that nobody is expected to basically look out for your liberation. This is your job. This is every person's job, and that's the point here. Thanks so much for calling, Sarah.
You're welcome, Utrecht.
Let's talk with Harvey from Berkeley next.
Hello, wonderful Utrecht.
Hello, wonderful Harvey. How are you doing in the methane California there?
I'm doing great. It's raining quite a bit here, so we're all kind of happy. And the trees and all the vegetables don't look so parched. So we're all kind of walking around, smiling in the rain here in Northern California. I don't know about Southern California, but that's the way we feel up here. Well, I just want to wish you a Happy New Year.
And, thank you. Same to you.
Happy New Year to your wonderful PRN listening audience.
Thank you for that.
Sure. And today I'd like to talk about the heartless Republican Party, and some of the Democrats have once again put American people in harm's way. First, they voted to offshore millions of American jobs, and now they want to take the food stamps away from as many as a million Americans. And here's the headline: don't expect food stamps if you're unemployed and childless. As many as a million Americans will be kicked off food stamps this year thanks to the return of federal rules targeting unemployed adults without children. The loss of this food assistance, which averages between $150 and $170 per person per month for this group, will cause serious hardship amongst many. And here's the problem with that. In 2015, American worldwide agricultural exports are forecast to exceed over $140 billion. We're exporting to the rest of the world $140 billion. Over $140 billion worth of food, while many Americans go hungry. The question is, are the agriculture companies going to sell the food that they've taken away from the unemployed Americans and make another few billion dollars profit on it? And when people lose nutrition, they become sick and require medical services, which will cost us, the American taxpayer, billions of additional dollars. And unfortunately, the Republicans are creating more crime and putting us all in harm's way. When people go hungry, they're desperate, and they turn to crime, to drugs, they turn to prostitution, and they've made us all vulnerable to these crimes. This will be a boon, of course, to the incarceration industry, especially the prisons for profit, the new slavery industry. And as robots come online and take more and more jobs and displace people, we are at a crossroads. And I believe that Robert Reich, I believe he's right in calling for a national guaranteed minimum income. And it's time to support our fellow Americans. It's the right thing to do.
But I'm concerned that you parked this bus right in the Republican garage. Yes. Are you exempting the Democrats and other political entities from blame or responsibility?
No, I'm not, because there are a certain number of Democrats who are Republican thinking. So even though they call themselves Democrats, they're really Republicans in thought and action. So it's both groups, but primarily the Republicans have overwhelmingly always supported the corporations over the people of America, and it just seems that's their job, is to take the commons and give it to the corporates. So I feel that this is really bad. I mean, when people are hungry, if here we are, we're exporting over $140 billion and over a million Americans are going to be walking around looking for food. Is there something wrong with this?
Well, what's worse is that, in fact, many in the agricultural world are actually receiving what is known as parity payments, and they are actually paid for not growing food, so as to maintain prices at a particular level. The theory being that the more food that is grown and is available, the more it will depress the prices they could demand on the open market. So many within that industry are actually earning money for not growing food. And this remains an abomination, that there's a possibility that, in fact, the hungry can be fed, food can be made available, if we have those people receiving parity payments from the government actually producing food and distributing it among communities that are distressed right here at home.
I completely agree with you.
Thanks for your call, Harvey. Thank you for contributing today. Let's talk to Patricia from New York next. Hello, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice, and good afternoon to the PRN family. Happy New Year.
Thank you, and good afternoon to you, too. And thanks for saluting everyone.
I want to follow up on Joel's comments about Bernie Sanders. Something interesting happened. I'm not really quite sure what mailing list I'm on. I sign a lot of petitions. But Bernie Sanders was in New York this week, and I received an invitation to attend the town hall. And so I went. And he spoke for an hour. And for an entire hour, he focused on the banks. He focused on Wall Street. He talked about breaking them up, breaking the banks up. He talked about too big to fail. He talked about reinstating Glass-Steagall. And every time he mentioned, justice, I thought he was going to start talking about police brutality and the killing of black and brown people. And he talked about putting the CEOs of the banks in jail. For an entire hour, all he talked about was Wall Street, as if that is the only problem. And so, you know, I absolutely agree with Joel. I absolutely agree. I listened to the program yesterday with Dr. Horn. I absolutely agree with him. Bernie Sanders is a Democrat. I don't know about this democratic socialist business. Bernie Sanders is a Democrat. And at this point, I have to ask myself, is he, what is that term that you use for people who don't really intend to win, but they're in the race?
I know, the pretend candidates, the shills.
Yeah. And I want you to know that the place erupted in pandemonium. And I said to myself, is this the only problem that exists? Absolutely not one mention of any issue for black and brown people. Not one. Now, in the audience, the unions brought out a lot of union people. Our town hall seats probably about maybe 1,500, 2,000 people. And I would say the bulk of the people there were brought out by the unions. And you did have a lot of seniors who, you know, are retired. You could tell that if you extracted the non-union people, the rest of the audience were seniors, retired seniors, who are clearly in his camp. But Bernie Sanders, you know, black and brown people are up a creek without a paddle. Absolutely. So, you know, I have shared with you on numerous occasions my sole participation, because Hillary Clinton is such an invective for me, that I would do anything to thwart her candidacy. And I don't care who says that she is the nominee, heir apparent. I would do anything to thwart her candidacy. So I'll probably, you know, pull the lever for Sanders in the primary, and that's as far as I'll go, because I'll do anything to thwart her ability to be the candidate, you know, without any competition.
Well, I note that you do not have within your realm of consideration the Green Party. Why?
You know what? Thank you for sharing that with me. I hadn't thought about it. I don't know why. I'm going to put that on my plate.
I think I might have a clue. And that is, the Green Party hasn't been making itself relevant.
You're probably correct.
I have never seen a vigorous, excited presence by the Green Party in any community of color. Ever. Their attitude seems to be, well, we're here, we're not the Democrats, and we're not the Republicans. So you should have enough sense to know that we are the best alternative. And that's where they leave it. They don't seem to be too animated about really wanting to reach out to voters and educate voters about why and how they have a stake in looking at an alternative. Maybe they aren't an alternative after all.
And, you know, Bernie Sanders' campaign is similar to a campaign that we had here in New York in 2014 when Cuomo ran for reelection, in that an unknown, you know, lawyer out of Fordham University mm-hmm. was able to garner 36% of the vote. And if she had only gone into black and brown communities, she would be governor. And Bernie Sanders, but I always got a feel from her that she never really wanted to be governor. She wanted to push Cuomo in the direction that she wanted to push Cuomo. Sanders wants to push Clinton in the direction that he wants, but neither one of them really wanted the position.
And this is in a state, certainly in a city, where the black and Latino votes in particular will always determine and have always determined political outcomes.
Exactly. And Bernie should know that he can't go into South Carolina with what he just did in town hall and think that that's going to fly, because it certainly didn't fly with me. And if that's the message he's taking into South Carolina, he either thinks that black and brown people in South Carolina are idiots, or they have no concerns outside of the banks and Wall Street. But the other issue that I want to raise, and I don't know you, it's quite possible that you have covered this while I was MIA, is that now in Michigan, everybody is focused on the lead poisoning of the children and the issue of the water in Flint. All of a sudden.
You did that so long ago.
All of a sudden, everybody wants to fire the governor and sue the governor. The governor has apologized and done all of these things. Too little, too late for the thousands of children that were poisoned by lead through the water.
Yes,
all of
we
a
did.
Sudden, I see nothing but
a couple of programs on it here. That was somewhere before the summer, as a matter of fact.
Oh, absolutely. We were on this almost a year ago, and now everybody is on it now. Months after the damage was done.
Well, where are you leaning? What is your attitude politically now?
Politically, I will not, outside of trying to thwart Hillary and that one activity, I'm done. My position has not changed.
Okay. Well, do call us again and let us know. We keep taking your temperature, your political temperature,
every couple of weeks
just to find
that,
out.
That is not going to change. Hillary gets more putrid by the day. I mean, more putrid. I keep telling people that this is not a one person. This is a twofer. You're getting Hillary and Bill all over again. This is not one person. You got a twofer.
It is Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde.
That's right. Thanks, Patricia, for your call today. Let's go to Chicago. Henry, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice. How's it going?
Great. Thank you. How are you doing?
Doing good. I want to wish you and the rest of the PRN audience a very happy, prosperous 2016.
Thank you. And the same to you.
Thank you. Wanted to bring back to light since the last couple of months of 2015 has been, you know, talking about presidential campaigns, police killings of unarmed black people. The one thing we might have to refocus on, or not refocus on, but not forget about the struggle, is the war on education. You know, listening to Dr. Horn, you know, I thought about education again. And you know, reading some of the headlines that's going on with the Chicago Public Schools, and kind of brought me back to when I first started calling you almost 2 years ago, that one of my topics that I used to talk about a lot was education. Last week, well, not last week, but a couple of days ago, there was on the local news here the announcement of Catholic schools that were closing. Now, two of the Catholic schools are in predominantly African-American communities. And it made me go back to what, you know, what it made me think about the war on education again, because an unknown thing that's been going on is there have been more than 50 Catholic school closings in predominantly black areas over the last couple of years, which is, you know, being unsaid, you know, right now. And it made me go back to, you know, thinking, like I said, thinking about the war on education, because I was talking to my former sixth grade teacher, who is a principal at a Catholic school here. We had a long conversation about it. She's principal at a Catholic school, and she also worked at CPS as well. And she is, you know, strangely enough, seeing a lot of similarities within the Chicago Catholic School Archdiocese here and CPS, because, you know, as we were talking, a lot of businessmen are basically taking over the hierarchy of the Catholic schools here in Chicago, and this, you know, being the Catholic schools is the largest private school system in the country. We're starting to see it in the Catholic school systems as well. And you know, going back to CPS, there was a report that was done, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago. The criteria that they used, and I think this was an independent report, but the criteria that they used about 3 years ago when they closed those 50 schools in CPS about the underutilization, they went back and looked at a lot of all of the schools in CPS. They found there were 300 schools in CPS right now that are being underutilized, according to that criteria that they used 3 years ago to close those 50 schools. There are 300 schools right now. 300. And it kind of made me think, like, okay, so, you know, what is the purpose of this report, you know, coming out right now? You know, why all of a sudden there are 300 schools being utilized? I mean, quote unquote, being underutilized. And it just made me think, like, you know, this to me kind of verifies that those 50 schools that were closed 3 years ago had nothing to do with underutilization. And to me, the report kind of, like, you know, puts the point of the exclamation. Like, you can't tell me that you closed those schools for underutilization because they found 300 schools like this now. So what, you're going to close 300 schools this year? No, it's not. That's not going to happen. And also, too, the mayor, our beloved Mayor Rahm Emanuel, appointed another school board member, Ruiz, who, if you know his history, he is a staunch advocate for the charter school system. He was appointed to the CPS Board of Education, which, you know, as you know, is not elected like some other, you know, school boards. So everything up top is appointed, you know, along with the CEO and superintendent, which, you know, CPS is, you know, like I always say, it's a business. It's not about educating kids. But the attack on education is going all, you know, coming from all sides, and we really need to, you know, not take our attention away from it, even though there's a lot of other things that's going on. However, too, there is a looming teacher strike that's about to happen, possibly in the next couple of months or maybe next couple of weeks, because the teachers union here in Chicago has formally asked Rahm to resign. So it's another turn of, you know, what's going to happen, you know, with the teachers union again. So just wanted to kind of bring that up again as a topic of, you know, what we really need to watch in 2016. Oh, also, too, I've also read something about a teacher in New York who was fired for teaching about the case of the Central Park Five. and it was just odd, you know, looking at that article as well, because I was like, wow, you know, you get fired for teaching somebody the truth now in public schools. So,
well, just to remind you, we've discussed this question about why schools are being shut down and they have nothing to do with education. You may recall Dr. Thomas Pedroni, who has been on our program several times, talking about the forecasting by real estate interests about which communities are going to be marked for turnarounds and which communities are not going to be marked for turnarounds. And it's on the basis of a very insidious plan in which certain communities are being predicted as communities that have potential to generate revenue. It's on the basis of this that these decisions are made to shut down schools. The Catholic Church, and this is something I think I will further investigate, the Catholic Church is also playing the real estate game. They have these schools, and the decision is that the student body now has become largely black and brown and poor. That's not revenue for the church, not in the way it expects revenue. But if they have the real estate, and the real estate is important. In Harlem, for example, a lot of these schools that are now being turned over to private interests to develop into lofts and luxury apartments, they will make more money that way. So these communities are targeted. And, of course, Detroit is wide open. Chicago, certain neighborhoods in Chicago, wide open. All around the country, this is happening, both in the private sector and the public sector. So I think I'd revisit this with Dr. Pedroni, because he talked about first you kill the schools, and that's what's behind this racist attack on public school education in just about every African-American and Latino community across the United States. This is happening. So you're right to sense that this is a major issue, because it is.
And, Eutrice, you know, I thought about something, too. Majority of the Catholic schools that have been closed here in Chicago have been sold to CPS to turn into charter schools.
And of course, because the charter schools, they have money. They're willing to. The charter schools are going to be they're destined to be the primary educators of black and brown children across the nation.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. They're preparing for that to happen. We talked about that with Dr. Pedroni as well. So time to bring him back and revive this discussion. Thanks so much for calling, Henry.
All right, thank you.
Thanks. Let's go next to Willie from New York. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, beloved.
Oh, hello, Willie. How are you?
Okay, beloved. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. How are you doing this year?
I'm okay, honey. How's your health?
Good. I'm hanging in.
Good. You know,
and frustrating the enemy. I said I'm hanging in and frustrating the enemy.
That's right. Thank you for the work you're doing and the people at PRA. Eutrice, I remember a couple of years, I've been listening for a long, long, long time. And, you know, you always said racism is a science. I just saw it. I just began to see it. Monday, I was home from work, and I was listening to a program on the other station, and I said, my God, now I really see. It was so plain. Now, just 20 years later, 10, 15 years later, I just saw it. It was so plain. From the work you're doing and that other individual at the other station, I said, oh, my God. Because I remember when you took control of that station and you got rid of the people who were obstructing the work that you guys were doing. They were threatening your life. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
I certainly do.
And you were one of many people from the community who were very, very concerned and physically were at the station to make sure that we were safe. And I thank you for that. I won't forget it.
And I said, this is why when a brother said, well, I love you, sister, please don't come to move it. Because I remember there were three of us at that station every night. And the reason why I was there, and I'm going to die anyway, but when they begin to threaten your life based on a lie, I said, I think this is a good time for me to die. I think it's because when you did Malcolm, I said, you're not going to do this, sister, because we are all going to die. I'm going to die taking other men down with me because, you know, and for brothers to, you know, not to, they taught the game. The work that PRN and, you know, Gary has been, for example, look at the work that Gary's doing for your health. Now, for lack of a better word, I can't say a white man because Gary's not a white man or a black man. He's an angel. And he is putting his life, you and Wolf, out there every day trying to educate us. our job, from my vantage point, we're complaining about, I have no interest in what's going on in Washington. I don't care about them people. Because from my vantage point, it's just a crime syndicate. That's all it is. And our brother, Obama, you know, he just did a wonderful game. Because, you know, even Bush and the Republicans, they really had people hurting. So everybody, oh, let's get a black guy. We don't wait. People say, we don't care about that. Let's get a black guy. Oh, yeah? You don't have black gangsters? Remember Nicky Barnes? That's how it was. And as far as I'm concerned, I can't say it's a crime syndicate, because a crime syndicate, they have code of conduct. These people is just unthinkable. And so we have something in place that we could do whatever we want to do in this world. Because Gary, I remember they were trying to censor Gary. Remember that? Same people. And what did Gary do? He created PRN. Now they have no control over PRN. We have some of the best minds at PRN. Our job is to promote PRN, make PRN. This is something we have. Now, what do? We make it the voice of America. I don't care about NBC, CBS. I don't care about those things. Because I know that this is something that we could do. Because right now, the work that you guys are doing, you know, sometimes I'm listening and say, my God, you know, the circle of friends that I form, I said, you know, this is some rough stuff, man. Because these people, they put their lives on the line. And I'm saying to them, okay, here's what we're going to do. Some of us have printed up business cards and all kinds of stuff. I said, just distribute these cards, because once we begin to do this and make sure people begin to listen, gradually bring them in, particularly three people, you, Gary, and Wolf. Once people begin to understand how this system works, then we don't have to worry about them getting, the people will take them down on us, and that's what has to be done. We can't look at the system for anybody that they put in front of us from either party to do anything for us. We have to do this for ourselves. You know, UTS, this morning I heard a report, and I said, my God, this is one of the finest time in our lives. What I've heard in Guatemala, the gangsters, same criminals that the U.S. and put in power to torture and kill people, and you know the atrocity committed against innocent people. I mean, it's coming to an end. That world that they have created, it's got to go. Capitalism, nationalism, racism, sex, all of the things have got to go. But we have to do it. That's how I see it. You know, so let me say this. The circles, you know, Gary has provided the health care. Well, look, we have to begin to, you need stuff for yourself. We can't look for Gary to do this. It's not right, because we have a lot of money. Why not make use, pay you like they pay Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, or anybody? You see what I'm saying?
I value what you're saying, which is to say that when a thing is useful and helpful, especially in broadening your vision and enlightening you and teaching you, and it is a medium within which you can connect with others of like mind, it is worthy of support. And I thank you so much for that sentiment, because I know you don't just talk, you have been doing this. You walk the walk, that and you talk the talk, but you walk the walk. That's the thing. And this was made clear as well by Sarah today, saying that when you find something that is valuable, but you don't support it, then you are also, you know, culpable in the sense of if it should wither away and die. This is important. When you find something that is working, helping you to see the world far more intuitively than you would have, when it helps you make sense of the universe, the way you talked about today, understanding systems, and you get it. Racism is a system. These are systems. If you got that alone, that's worth the price.
Can I say this to you, Therese?
Because we're ending shortly.
Yeah, okay. Let me say this real quick. The thing is, we already have something in place. I'm thinking, well, Garinald should, well, not that, he's doing too much work. We cannot kill him. But if we admit this is what it should be, he should be up there with the candidates, because he would be able to put the issues, the true issue, the truth out there, so people would understand. The problem with the American people, they've just been misled and misguided. PRN can do this.
Well, PRN is doing its job, and what it's doing is providing information and providing a forum for the exchange of information, and that's what I enjoy doing, and that's what I've been doing all of my professional life. And I hope to continue doing that as long as I can. And that is, in my view, fulfilling my mission here on this planet. Doing this work is important to me.
We have to help. That's our job. I'm not talking about the people appearing. I'm talking about the people who are listening. That's our job, to make this the voice of America. That's all. And the things that we want to see, the nation that we want to see, the policy that we want to see, everything will fall right into space, because the truth needs no defense. So anyway, I'll let somebody else get on. I love you, my sister. Peace.
Thank you so much, Willie, for your call today, and a great, great happy new year to you. And that brings us to the end of our program today. Lots of wonderful ideas that were floated, which caused us. Stay tuned. Next, Buns and Butter. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, and we'll see each other on Monday. In the meantime, know for me, it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.